everyone. My name is Kathy Smith, and on behalf of Calvin Theological Seminary and the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship, I welcome you to the Fall Preaching Conference. We are very glad that you've come today, and we'd like to acknowledge that this conference is sponsored by the Center for Excellence in Preaching of our seminary, and we are thrilled to have you be a part of this day. Many of you have come from a ways today, have driven quite a ways. Many of you also have been participating in some of our book groups, either here on campus or in other places, and we thank you for that participation. We're glad that you're here. Some of you had a little trouble finding a parking space this morning, and we apologize for that. We had a great turnout here, and we have some construction going on. Hopefully, those who are still on their way from the parking area will find a hospitable welcome, and we can make room for those who will be coming in a little late. But we thank you for your patience in that regard. In just a moment, our president, Cornelius Planninga, is going to introduce our speaker. And then following the first presentation this morning, we'll have a short time for some questions and answers. There will be other time during the day for that. And before we have a break, I'll give you a few announcements once everyone is here. But thanks again for being here, and let's open the conference with a word of prayer. Everlasting God, in whom we live and move and have our being, you have made us for yourself so that our hearts are restless until they rest in you. Bless us this day as we greet one another, as we renew friendships, as we learn together. Bless our speaker with clarity of thought and speech. Strengthen and encourage him, and through him, all of us. Grant that the words he speaks this day may take root in our hearts and bear fruit to your honor and glory. For the sake of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. It's a great honor to have the Reverend Dr. Craig Barnes with us today to speak and to discuss with us. Dr. Barnes is no stranger to this campus. He was here in January for the symposium, and he was here again this past summer for one of the summer seminars. Several of us here were present for that seminar. Dr. Barnes graduated from King's College in Briarcliff Manor, New York, with majors in history and education. He's also a graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary for his MDiv in 1981. After which he served as a pastor at the First Presbyterian Church of Colorado Springs, Colorado. He earned his PhD in 1982 from the University of Chicago. His dissertation advisor was Martin Marty, who writes so many books that it is said somebody once called and asked for him, and his secretary said, "I'm sorry, he's working on a book," and the person said, "I'll hold." What's remarkable about Dr. Barnes' career is that he has managed to do several things simultaneously almost all the time. So while he was working on his PhD at the University of Chicago, he was also pastor of Christ Presbyterian Church in Madison, Wisconsin. And Chicago is not an easy PhD, so that was remarkable. In 1993, he began a pastorate at National Presbyterian Church in D.C., and then in 2002 joined the faculty of Pittsburgh Theological Seminary in Pittsburgh, where he is a prof in the ministry division, and he is now also pastor and head of staff at Shadyside Presbyterian Church. So he's both a pastor and a prof. This summer I asked him about that, and maybe he'll say something to you like what he said to me. He and his wife, Ann, reside in Pittsburgh, where he runs as frequently as possible with his golden retriever named Martin Luther, who he comments is fortunately getting older. He's the author of six books. They're listed in the handout you received, And we are focusing today on his book, Searching for Home, Spirituality for Restless Souls. It's a great honor to have you, Craig. I welcome you to this podium, and I invite all of us to show our guest a good welcome.
The focus of the book, Searching for Home, is on the changing cultural context in which we are conducting our ministries. Now, there's nothing novel about that thought, that culture is changing. And this book never presumed to place itself alongside other much more important books that are challenging some of the postmodern ideological assumptions upon which people are either wittingly or unwittingly building their lives today. This book has a much more modest goal, which is to say that our notion of home has changed. And with that has come pretty significant changes in people's self-understanding. Historically, home is the place where identity is nurtured, where mission is discovered, where people are told who they are and what they are about. But with the rapidly changing dynamics about home, people are having a tremendous amount of confusion then about some of the things that used to be the blessings of home, such as identity and mission. Have you noticed how many debates we have these days about identity issues? Ethnic identity, religious identity, sexual identity, and I'm sure that these identity debates are going to continue for quite a while. My thesis in this book is that these are rooted in a more fundamental confusion about home. Let me work out of one particular section of the book to try to make the case for this, and then conclude with some implications for ministry that I think this has. Let me quickly try to do a historical survey of the last three generations' perspectives on home and to demonstrate how that has changed. And to make this a bit more personal, let me use my grandfather, my father, and my daughter, which allows me to skip me. My grandfather's generation, what I've called the settler generation, my father's generation, what I've called the exile generation, and then my grown daughter's nomadic generation, the settlers. In our home, on one of the walls, right by now by the dining room table, we have six large black and white photographs of farm families. Each of these families is sitting on the same porch of the farm that they inherited from the family in the photograph before them. These are my ancestors. These are the Barneses, six generations of rugged North Carolina tobacco farmers. That's where I come from. It's not a good career field to be getting into now, but that's my heritage, and it's right there on the wall. And every time I have dinner, it's with the communion of saints who are all around me. The last of these photographs is of the last people who had the farm, my grandparents, Clarence Solomon Barnes and my grandma Ada Barnes. When you look at these photographs, you would say these people belong on that farm. In fact, it's hard to tell where the farmer stops and the farm starts in these pictures, because these farms have so shaped not just the identity, but even the appearance of these farmers. And their self-understanding was totally shaped by those acres of land. Remember when the whole roots phenomena was really big about what was that, 25 years ago, Alex Haley's book came out, we were all trying to figure out where we came from. My grandmother was still alive, and so my brother and I went to the farm. We got interested in this. We wanted to figure out where we came from, and so we said, "Grandma, where did we come from?" And she looked at us as if that was a very puzzling question, and she said, "North Carolina." Well, we know that, but where did we come from to get here? "We've always been here in North Carolina." And she tells us again the story of the six farm families who've each inherited the farm. And I said, "Well, I know that, Grandma, but we haven't all, I mean, we're not Indians. We came from somewhere. I'm thinking Europe." She was offended by the notion that we had European ancestry. "No, we have always lived in North Carolina." And that was the end of the conversation. I was fascinated by that. Because this was not a dumb woman, but she had so rewritten the oral tradition that she couldn't imagine her family ever being anywhere other than a place tied to that land. Now, in addition to all of these generational photographs, we have one other photograph on our wall, which is on a separate wall. This is a picture of my grandfather as a 20-year-old young man. In this photograph, he's wearing a zoot suit. He's sitting on a crescent moon holding a saxophone. This picture was taken in Miami, Florida. This is why it gets its own wall. When I inherited these photographs from my aunt, I came up to this one and I said, "What is this?" Of all the stories I heard Granddad tell, I never heard him say anything about hanging the moon in Miami, Florida. She says, "Oh, he didn't talk much about that. But when your granddad was a young man, he didn't really like life on the farm that much, and he had this lifelong dream to leave the farm and join the big bands." I said, "No kidding. I never heard that. Well, that's great." She says, "Well, no, it really didn't work out that well." As soon as he could, he ran away from home. He walked down the county road to the state road, to the paved road, as they called it. Made his way down there, got a job with the bands. But he soon found that life on the road was filled with loneliness and women who terrified him. And as soon as he could, the prodigal son came home and never again left the farm till the day he died. What that means to me is that before my grandfather ever tried to leave the farm, he had already inherited an identity. That's the point. That's how you used to get identities. They were inheritances. His came to him as an inheritance from his parents and his grandparents who lived in the same farmhouse, from aunts and uncles who lived on farmhouses just down the county road, from his school teacher who was also his Sunday school teacher, from the preacher at the Rocky Mount Baptist Church, and from his lifelong girlfriend, my grandma, who said she wouldn't marry him until he got this fool idea about the big bands out of his system. And the only time in his otherwise long and purposeful, fulfilled life that he was confused was when he tried to be somebody other than who the community told him that he was. That's what home used to do. It told you who you are, and thus what you are about. Now, at the same time that my grandfather was having that experience in rural America, immigrants who were very clear about coming from Europe were living in urban ethnic communities in neighborhoods that were designed to maintain the ethnic identity of the old country. It was essentially the same agenda, though. Home was telling you who you are in those urban communities. You could move out of the apartment into another apartment, but if you moved out of the neighborhood, they would have a funeral for you. It was unthinkable that you would move out of the neighborhood, because the neighborhood was where the all of the identity issues were inculcated. You would go down, it's where the restaurants were that would serve food from the old country. It's where you heard the mother tongue of the old country. It's where you would go to worship, and they brought a priest over from the old country who spoke the language of the old country, because that's the language God spoke, and worship had to be done in that language. And this was all ways of telling you kind of who you are and what you are about. And there were similar rural ethnic places that fulfilled the same kind of a function. After the emancipation of the African slaves in our country, they didn't all hop trains and move to New York. They formed neighborhoods not far from where they formerly were on plantations. And they built these communities around small framed churches, a symbol, by the way, of the religion adopted typically from the slave masters. But again, that was written out of the oral tradition, so that the church became a settling force for them. They stayed there not because life was better in those poor black neighborhoods, but because it was all they knew, because it was all they were given, and because it was home. I could say the same thing about poor Hispanic neighborhoods in the Southwest. When the railroads made it out there, they didn't all come east because they stayed home. For centuries and centuries and centuries, that's how the families of Earth lived. They settled land, or they settled ethnic urban neighborhoods, and they settled for what they knew, settlers. Now, those old homes weren't easy places to be by any means. Work was hard, and luxuries were completely non-existent. The turn of the 20th century, half of Americans still had no indoor plumbing. And the average life expectancy was only 54 at the turn of the 20th century. Only 54, which was just as well because nobody had a pension then. Work week was at least 60 hours if you were lucky enough to have work, and of course, women worked a lot more than that. Even by the time I came along, when I would spend my summers on my grandparents' farm, I could tell that that wasn't an easy life. Sweat and toil was as much a part of their life as was the old yellowed wallpaper on that farmhouse that entombed them long before they ever died. Now, it was precisely the severity of their life that made the settlers nurture a vision of another place, a different place, a better place called heaven. That was their real home, and it was waiting just up ahead. The placement of heaven during this period as being in the future is significant. They knew it wasn't behind them. It certainly wasn't with them. So it had to be ahead of them. In doing the research for this book, I spent a boatload of time analyzing sermons from the beginning of the 20th century. And if you do this, and I recommend this kind of exercise, you'll be amazed at how many of the sermons were on heaven. It was one of the most frequently preached about topics, always placed in the future, waiting up ahead as future reward. This was one of the reasons why, and it was in the early 20th century, that Marx made the critique he did about religion as being this opiate, that up there you'll get the reward, up there just to live with the oppressive forces now. The fact of the matter is, we did always talk about heaven as future reward. It's seen not only in the sermons, but also in the hymnody of this period. Typical is the hymn "In the Sweet By and By," published in 1868. "There's a land that's fairer than day, and by faith we can see it afar. For the Father waits over the way to prepare us a dwelling place there. In the sweet by and by we shall meet on that beautiful shore. In the sweet by and by we shall meet on that beautiful shore. We shall sing on that beautiful shore the melodious songs of the blessed, and our spirits shall sorrow no more, not a sigh for the blessing of rest. No more sorrow, but rest when you get on the other side of the beautiful shore. To our bountiful Father above, we will offer our tribute and praise for the glorious gift of his love and the blessings that hallow our days." Bent over from the burdens of life, settlers all over the country would make their way into those framed churches to sing this song that just pulsed through their veins. In doing so, they confessed a great hope. One day we'll cross the river of death and we'll meet on the beautiful shore. By faith we can see it afar. That's what faith is. It's a way of seeing something that's afar. And when we get there, then our spirits will sorrow no more. But it's the last line of the hymn that I think that demonstrates the theological truth that Marx missed by about at least Christianity. That this gift of this promise of another home that's waiting up ahead is a blessing that hallows the day we have now. So that the present tense isn't just waiting for the future. But the present has meaning and it has purpose and it has mission precisely because of the claims of the future upon the present. And when you live with a vision of the future, that gives meaning and order to a day that otherwise is just severe. So they weren't just gutting out the day they had. They had a sense of missional commitment to endure the severity of it so that they, because it was all a way of getting to that point where one day they would meet on the beautiful shore, and the Father in heaven above would say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." By the way, that's the phrase you hear in all those sermons from the early part of the 20th century. Don't you want to hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant"? And you're supposed to, of course, say, "Yes, I'll go back to the farm." Now, although it didn't make a great splash in American society, it was during the same period that theological liberalism was paramount, especially in the thinking of European Christian intellectuals, which, as you know, advocated that through innate human potential, it's going to be possible for us to build the kingdom of God on earth. As profound and as sophisticated as German liberal theological claims are, the thing that I'm fascinated by is that they shared one thing in common with simple American frontier and immigrant religion, namely, the belief that heaven was up ahead, the placement of it in the future. And the hope was to inspire faithfulness in the day that you have. For the liberals, that would mean until you could get further along in progress. And for my grandfather, it meant that you would just continue in faithful service. But the good thing, the kingdom, the heaven, the home, all located in the future. Now, society changed when my father was a young man and the settler generation gave way to a whole new social phenomena that we had never seen before. Technology, industry, education, government, they all became unwitting partners in inviting my father's generation to leave the farm, which they did in droves. Not only did they leave the farms, they also left the old ethnic urban neighborhoods. Chasing the promise of a better life, hundreds of thousands of young people took advantage of a brand new thing called the GI Bill. They used that to go to another brand new thing called the Land Grant University. We see these enormous state universities. We have the feeling that they've been around since the Declaration of Independence, but they haven't. Many of them are 20th century creations. They got degrees, college degrees, something that never would have occurred to my grandfather, that any of his kids could go to college. It never even dawned on him that that was a possibility. When they got their college degrees, they got jobs with another brand new thing called the multinational corporation. And these corporations settled their new employees in new places, brand new places called the suburbs, which were far away from the old city neighborhoods and the farms. But my father's generation never forgot where home was. Nobody originally thought home was in the suburbs. They always knew that home was still in the farm or the old ethnic neighborhoods. That's why they're exiles. Exiles know where home is, they're just not living there. But their identity still comes from home, not from the burbs. Now, the exiles were relatively comfortable living on their beautifully sculptured avenues and in their, as my mother called it, my all-electric home by GE. She would just get starry-eyed is she? Can you imagine that, an all-electric home, Craig? That's all I could imagine, actually. By wonderful messianic GE had provided this kitchen for her. Now, this is the fascinating part about this kitchen is that it had time-saving devices. She grew up as a little girl watching her mother devote her entire day to the kitchen because it took all day. And my mother had things which saved time. I remember her getting weepy-eyed just with the invention of the crock pot. She could just put food in there and just walk away and come back later and be ready. And there were all these instant foods that came out, little foods with little pieces of tinfoil on it. And you just throw it in the oven and it comes out and it's there it is. And she was amazed by all these things which gave her time in her home, something that her mother never, ever had. I'm going to come back to that in just a second. So life was comfortable there in the suburbs. But it's striking that every Christmas they would load my brother and I and up and throw us in the back of the station wagon and say, what? We got to go home. It's Christmas. Got to go home for Christmas. So they always knew where home was, but only for a visit. The exiles never wanted to live at home, but they never forgot where it was. They just remained a little nostalgic about it, remembering the blessings and forgetting the severity. We would only stay at the farm long enough for it to be kind of a hassle, and then we would go back to the burbs. Now, during this period, the 1950s is what I'm talking about, religion in America flourished as a greater percentage of Americans started attending church than we had ever seen before. This, for American historians, this is the bubble period of church attendance. And there are all of these theories as to why so many people came to church in the 50s. And it's one of the things that, I mean, people write journal articles back and forth about. This is a whole area of specialization within modern American church history as to account for this bubble. I mean, at the colonial periods, the statistics vary depending upon which researcher you're looking at, but they range from 11 to 17% of the people were in church on a given Sunday in the colonial days. 11 to 17%. We tend to think that's where everybody went to church every week, and that's just not true. 11 to 17%. The numbers for the 1950s range all above 50%. Some of them are as high as 60% of Americans were in church on a given Sunday. Not members, but worshiping. Staggering statistics of people going to church during this period. Why was that? Why was it that life, business that got big in the 50s and early 60s, and government that got big in the 50s and 60s, so did Protestant denominations get big in the 50s and 60s? With home offices in New York or Chicago or Grand Rapids, branch offices out on the corners of all these suburbs called local churches. Have you ever driven around and noticed how many churches look like they had 1960s architecture? Because they do. That was a time when we were expanding out into all of the burbs. As the burbs, so did churches. And frequently developers gave land to churches because they wanted a church there because it made for a better neighborhood. And the churches in the burbs were filled. Unlike the Hebrew exiles, the American exiles very much wanted to sing the Lord's song in exile. They wanted to do that. That's why the churches were filled. Again, that's why there are all these theories as to what was going on that made that happen. I have my own theory. That theory is that as nice as it was to have matching avocado kitchen appliances, the exiles knew they weren't home and they missed it. They longed for it. Now, the religious agenda of the exiles was to relocate the heavenly home. They transformed it from being the romanticized home behind them to being the home above them. All of the sermons from this period, again, a tremendous number of sermons about heaven in the 50s, but they always place heaven above the congregation, never ahead of the congregation. That's a significant shift in relocating the geography of heaven to now being above us. Now, by putting it above us, it's an inspiring ideal. It gives us a vision of the of living in the day that we have, because we now live under heaven. It was in 1954 that we inserted the phrase "a nation under God" into the Pledge of Allegiance, because we were all thinking about being under God, under heaven, at this period, striving to make a planned community resemble the order and the unity of home as classic exilic behavior. And that's what we were doing. There's a resurgence of Augustinian studies during this period, led by Reinhold Niebuhr. City of God, city of earth. Again, vertical thinking. Neo-Orthodoxy burst onto the scene, sweeping away vague liberal notions that were moving somehow progressively towards a new kingdom, and which is no longer credible after the horror of two wars. Now there's a resurgence of the radical transcendence of God, known only by the self-revelation of the Word in Christ. And thus revelation is no longer horizontal, but it's now vertical. And a generation of seminarians cut their teeth on that theology and then went out to preach it again to their filled congregation in the suburbs. In addition to the sermons and the theology of this period, again, the hymnody of it is illustrative. This world is not my home. Remember that hymn? That was published during this period, 1946. This world's not my home. I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up. Anybody know? Somewhere beyond the blue. Right, up there. That's where it is. And it goes on to talk about my Savior pardon me from guilt and the shame I know. I'll trust his saving grace while traveling here below. I know he'll welcome me in heaven's open door, but I can't feel at home in this world anymore. I have a precious mother up in glory land, and so forth and so on. Very vertical images. Somewhere beyond the blue is our transcendent home. That's where our true treasure lies. The goal here is to make this home look like that home as much as we can. That's why so many community organizations started during this period. Rotaries, kinds of things, civic organizations like that. And good Christian men and women were called to volunteerism. Volunteerism just took off during this period. Unlike in my grandparents' period, because no one had time in my grandparents' day to be a volunteer. But they did in this time. And so you were not only an elder in your church or a Sunday school teacher, but you also ran the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts, and you were a Rotarian, and you were a Lions Club person. And frankly, there were very thin walls between all of us. It was all about establishing the settling of Christendom. And there was a prevailing mythology of what the good Christian America looked like, and you were all contributing to that through citizenship. And Christianity and citizenship were almost synonymous. Women's organizations developed like crazy in the community as well as in the churches. By the way, that was the purpose, or at least that was the understood purpose, of all those time-saving devices in the kitchen. That created a new career opportunity for women called the church volunteer. My grandmother was not a church volunteer. She just couldn't have done it. I mean, she would make some chicken for the monthly church picnic, all day singing dinner on the ground thing, but that was it. There was no women's association in my grandmother's day. That was my mother's phenomenon. And she had the freedom to do that, and that's why she had all of these time-saving devices in the kitchen, so she could go to the church and volunteer, just as she would volunteer in some of the other things in the community. And that was her career. She was devoted to that. That was her self-understanding. Her whole identity was caught up with the role of volunteer, something that subsequent generations have demeaned and perhaps forgotten about the vocational aspects of volunteerism for those women, exilic women. They're also very big, because they're order people living under heaven, exilic thinkers who are, by the way, still on the boards of our churches, are very big on order and rules. If I preach too many sermons that talk about how God finds us in the malaise of how it is between how it ought to be, these guys just glaze over. They have no idea what I'm talking about. And they'll greet me at the door and they'll say, I was working on this sermon. Do you want me to teach Sunday school? Is that what this was about? Just tell me what to do, because I'm good at following the rules. They're also good, by the way, at writing rules. In my tradition, we have this thing called the Book of Order. In my grandfather's day, the Book of Order fit in a man's shirt pocket. It's now a 2-volume set. that we have. It's about that thick. That's the exiles that did that to us. Because they trust rules. They're not legalists in the sense of thinking they're going to get to heaven on rules, but they think it's the way that they express their faith, by order. They like order and things which are done out of a sense of a commitment to order. It's all a way of living under God, so, because they know where home is. Quickly, let me get to my daughter's generation, the nomads. Unlike the settlers and the exiles, nomads don't have a clue where home is. They're just wandering from place to place. Ask many younger people today where home is, and you're going to get a long answer. They'll tell you about the three or four places they lived as a kid. And then they'll say something about, but now my parents live in Arizona. And I've never been there, except to visit. Or they'll say something sentimental about home is where I hang my hat. If you ask them why they live where they live today, 9 times out of 10, the answer will involve a job. What they won't say is that they can't imagine moving, like my grandparents. Not only can my grandparents not imagine moving, they can't imagine anybody in their lineage having ever moved, because they were so settled. Well, the contemporary nomad would move at the drop of a hat if the right reasons came up to move. And typically, a good job in another place would be a good enough reason to drop everything and move. Now, I know that there are places in the country where this is more acutely obvious than in others. I came from Washington, D.C., where it was extremely obvious. Maybe Grand Rapids, it's not as obvious. But it's coming. It's coming like a tidal wave to all cultures, a sense of transiency, a lack of any identity being derived from a geographic location. Because increasingly, the experience of young people is to live in a world that has no borders to it. When my daughter was in her last year of college, she studied in Florence. At least that's what she told us. But she did a lot of traveling while she was there. She told us this one great story, which illustrates my point. One morning, she woke up and decided she didn't want to go to class. And I know Lindsay will have to know she didn't have a thought about this until she was having breakfast. She decided she was going to go to Budapest. It just got in her mind. Okay, let's go to Budapest. So she goes and she catches the train, and she takes the train and goes to Budapest. She gets to Budapest and realizes she has no money. Another classic thing of my daughter's. But it's not a problem. She just goes to the ATM and gets money out of the Washington, D.C. Bank account that I put in there for her. Then she uses this money to go to an internet cafe in Budapest, where she wrote a note to her closest best friend who was studying in Brazil at the time. Now, there's not a one of you in the room who's a bit impressed by that story, because it's so commonplace. But imagine how my grandfather would have responded to this story. He never got money out of a machine a day in his life. You get money from a teller. And if you're in Europe, you have to wire it over there. It takes a long, it's a complicated thing to get there. And what's an internet cafe? What's an internet? And how can you be in Budapest if your closest friend is in Brazil? That's not close. You can't be closest friends if she's in Brazil and you're in Budapest. And what the heck are you doing in Budapest in the first place? That's what he would say. Even when I was growing up, Budapest was a bad place. You weren't allowed to go there. They had a wall around it, remember? And that's where the bad people lived. We were the good people. That was our mythology. They were the bad people. And they had a wall there because it was a bad place and the people wanted to get out. But the mythology they told on the other side of the wall is that you're the good people. And it's those Westerners that are the bad people, and we've got to put a wall up to keep them from coming in and getting you. And we're protecting you with this wall. So we had two competing mythologies, but that told people where their home was. And as awful as the Iron Curtain was, part of what it did is it told you where you belonged. You belong either on this side of the wall, you belong on that side of the wall. And those people over there are bad, and that's why we had this fence up. Now, I grew up with that mythology, which helped me know that I belong over here. My daughter and her generation have grown up in a world without any walls in it. No mythology that this place is better than that place, that we're the good people and they're the bad people. She doesn't think that. And so she has the ability to travel everywhere, which I think actually is her goal. But here's my point. She's at home nowhere. If you ask her where home is, and I spent a lot of time researching this book asking her and all of her friends about home, and they finally just got fed up with me asking questions about it because it irritated them because they didn't know the answer and they felt stupid that I kept asking about this. I even had to explain the concept to some of her friends of what I was talking about home. They didn't even really get it because they just keep moving and there are people who are on the move. I could go on to talk about telecommuting and teleconferencing and all the problems with the home office and some other things which we're doing today, which are making us strangers to geography. I could talk about postmodern literature, which has as its agenda not to tell you who you are, but to tell you to get used to not knowing who you are. The Utney Reader just did a whole series not too long ago on nomadism. I didn't invent these terms, by the way. One of the articles was written by Pico Iver, one of their favorite authors, who lives in rural Japan with his Japanese lover and her children. Her children speak no English. He speaks no Japanese. Nobody else in the rural villages speak English. And so he's very much alone out there. And he thinks this is a metaphor. Seems kind of desperate to me, but it made for a good article for the magazine. His point is that the biggest challenge today is to make peace with alienness. I actually think that is exactly the challenge today, that people are trying to make peace with alienness. Now, it used to be that we thought that being an alien was a bad thing, that people wanted to know where home was, where they belonged. But no one has the agenda outside of church circles now of telling people where home is. The agenda is to get used to being lost. Many of the postmodern novels, Richard Ford's would be typical if you want to read some of these. These novels just start nowhere and people kind of meander through and they end nowhere. These are frustrating novels to read, particularly if you like things like plot. Because people are just kind of meandering. And then the book is over. You think, did I lose a chapter at the end of the... Because nothing's getting wrapped up. Right. That's their whole point. That's the way life works now. Nothing's getting wrapped up. And the identity is no longer something that's thus inherited by this place where you belong. Now the identity is something that you construct. That's a big difference. When my daughter finally graduated from college, the commencement speaker looked out over thousands of graduates, and I can't believe he did this. He was peddling the same dribble I heard when I was graduated from college. You are among the brightest and best. You can be whatever you want to be. Set your goals high. Go out and achieve your dreams and make us proud. Well, that's not true. I mean, does anybody still think, well, apparently they do, that you can be anything you want to be? But that's still the compelling mythology. It's up to you to be what you want to be. You just have to construct it. And the way you make this construction of being what you want to be is through your choices. It all starts when you choose college. Remember, any of you have kids who've chosen college, you remember that this is something that for which you need Prozac just to get through this process, because it's so terrifyingly depressing. Because these kids are frightened that they're going to make the wrong choice. And they have reach schools and safety schools. And God help if you don't get into your reach school or if you find out that your reach school is somebody else's safety school. And there's all this kind of competitiveness to it. And the whole thought is if you don't get into the school of your dreams, then your life is already over. Just stop playing the game. And then if you get into school, then you've got to pick a major. If that doesn't work, then you pick another major. And then you pick another major, I discovered. Then after you finally get out of school, then they start saying, pick a job. I've been saying this a lot lately myself. Sweetheart, just pick a job. Anyone will be fine with me. And then, if that job turns out to not be a dream job but a nightmare, then you pick another job, and then you pick another job, and then you pick a community, you pick a church. If you don't like this church, you pick a different church. If you don't like this set of friends, you pick a different one. If you don't like this community, just go to another one. The assumption being, this is the point, if you don't like the life you have now, you can get a whole new life by making different choices, which is the exact antithesis of my grandfather's experience, that other people are making the choices and you're inheriting them. Now it's you've got to self-construct your own life, and it's up to you to do that however you can, and you just keep choosing so that we have churches which are filled with people who are wasting their fleeting years trying to find a life they like. They just keep choosing and choosing and choosing and choosing. They can't find anything they actually like. Half of our marriages aren't working out. Those statistics, as you know, aren't any better for Christians than non-Christians. Most people don't like their jobs. I would say for me as a pastor, right behind issues of relationships, work dissatisfaction is the thing I talk with my parishioners about the most. Took me a while to figure out why I had so many parishioners who were unhappy with their work until it finally dawned on me that they were expecting their work to be a source of fulfillment. That's a brand new notion, that work would be a source of fulfillment. Now it's so universally accepted that if work isn't fulfilling, then it's okay to quit and go get something else. But it's a new idea. Just be aware of that. I once asked my grandmother if granddaddy was fulfilled as a tobacco farmer. I had to explain the concept to her first. Oh, what's fulfillment? Oh, well, it's being really happy, and your work makes you happy. And finally, she said, "I don't know, sweetheart. He was a farmer," which was fascinating to me. That all those years, long, hard years of busting dirt behind a horse, and then finally a tractor. It never once occurred to my grandfather to ask himself if he was fulfilled in his work. He never once asked that question. Isn't that interesting? He came back to the farm not because it was fulfilling, but because he was a farmer. And he knew that because the community told him that. Well, we know what fulfillment is, and we look for it like the Holy Grail, but people's souls are wearing out, I'm telling you, trying to find a life they like. Let me quickly conclude with what I think are some pressing implications for ministry given this shift. One of them is that you have at least two of these generations in your churches, maybe three, but you have exiles and nomads in the church. And it may be that there's a kind of a passing of baton of leadership between exiles and nomads. But don't expect that to go easily or to go well. They're not trying to drive each other crazy, but you can see how completely differently they're wired about some very fundamental issues. And so the fascinating thing about being a pastor today is being a pastor with a church whose structures have been set by exiles who are trying to do relevant ministry to nomads with exilic structures in place. Don't expect, for example, nomads to get thrilled about the opportunity to become a member of the church. That's an exilic notion. Not even my grandparents thought, by the way, about being church members. They thought about belonging to the parish, this regional geographic center, and that was the local church. You just went to that church because it was your church. The whole notion of church as a voluntary association, much more exilic thinking, that you would join this, that you'd be a member of it. And I tried to get nomads to join my church. And they said, "Well, why do I need to do that?" I said, "Well, because you need to make a commitment to this church." "Well, what do I get out of being a member?" "Well, then you get to come to church meetings." "And a pledge card." "We only get pledge cards to members." "And you can't be an officer of the corporation unless you're a member." The nomads are kind of waiting for a compelling reason to join the church. What they want to join is the community. They want their relationships to be a part of this. My daughter, remember, maintains very close relationships with people who aren't even around her. Her relationships, I don't know how good she is at them, but they're important to her. They mean a lot to her. Identity issues are going to continue, as I said before, to be a pressing issue for this next generation. I think that's why there's so much pressure today on worship, because worship is the place where identity gets worked out. This will also stun you, but in my grandfather's day, nobody made suggestions to the pastor on what hymns they should sing. They just didn't really think that was something they needed to do. It wasn't that they didn't care, but they didn't have the expectations of worship that we have today of worship. Now, worship is a place where you go to renew, to rehearse identity, to be told once again who you really are in Christ. Now, these are wonderful things, but worship's having to carry pretty much the full weight of the identity inculcation that used to be shared by other places like home and school and Boy Scouts and all of these things shared in telling people who they are. Now people are very confused about who they are by the time they get to church, and they've learned to trust worship as the place where they can get clear once again about fundamental identity issues, and that's why there's so much pressure on worship, and that's why there's so many competing demands on worship, and that's why worship leaders are lightning rods for conflict, because of the high investment now that people have on worship to tell them what they are about. Last thing I'd want to say about this, because I'm using up all the time. It's a lot easier in some ways to do ministry now than it ever has been before. Now, it's harder in some ways because of these structural issues, these institutional issues, the shifting from a church structure based on exilic order to a ministry to nomads who don't have the high value on order. I understand the part about that's hard. You don't need me to convince you about the part that's hard today. We're all clear about that. I want to make a point about the excitement about doing ministry today. When you read through the New Testament understanding of home, is it not clear that it has radicalized the Old Testament understanding of home based on any geographic center? In the Old Testament, their home was determined by your geographic proximity to holiness. There was a holy land, which was made holy because it had a holy city in it. The holy city was holy because it had a holy temple in it. The temple was holy because it had a holy of holies in it. And the holy of holies was the place where God met humanity. Thus, you never wanted to be far from the land. That's why the Hebrew exiles could not sing the Lord's song in a foreign land, because home was geographically based. And it was geographically based because holiness was geographically captured in the Holy of Holies. When Jesus says, tear down this temple, and in 3 days, it'll be restored, he's identifying himself, of course, as the new meeting place between God and humanity. That's just one of the many ways that the whole story of Jesus radicalizes the notion of home. The whole incarnation begins with the birth of the Son of God to people who are not at home. The only people who saw the miracle of the Nativity were not at home. Nobody who's at home in the ordinary proper places saw it, even including the guy who just stayed in the inn. They all missed it. It was only the homeless, people who were on the road, who saw the miracle. And then he leaves home after 30 years, and he's inviting his disciples to leave home. And the only people who don't get to be disciples are those who are afraid to leave home, even those who have good reasons, like wanting to bury their dead fathers. Jesus won't even tolerate that. There's this radicalness of leaving the ordinary, the safe place, leaving home to follow. And then when he says, after his ascension, whatever, two or three are gathered here, I'll be there in the presence with them. That there's a way of knowing this meeting place between God and humanity, the Savior, on the road through community. And so what's happened is that home is no longer geographically based in the New Testament, but it's now community based. Wherever two or three gather together, I'll be with them. And the church is always sent on the road. The center of the church moves, as you know, from Jerusalem, that holy city, to Antioch, the missionary city that just kept sending people back out to go spread the gospel. And the church's model is not temple, it's much more tabernacle, that the church that's carried on the backs of the people, all along the ways of being a pilgrim people. I think that's the spiritual agenda today. I think that's the agenda of ministry today, to help people in the pilgrimage home to the kingdom that's on the way to them. Keeping people on the move to the kingdom that's on the move to them. Here's the final point. It's a lot easier to turn a nomad into a pilgrim than it is either a settler or an exile. Because nomads are on the move already. All that we're trying to do is to give purpose to their movement. The last thing you want to do is to nail a nomad down. You don't want them to settle. Jesus wouldn't ever let them settle. You want to keep them moving. You just want to tell them what they're moving towards. You want to show them about the kingdom. You want to show them about the purposefulness of a mission with life that keeps them on the move towards the Savior that is moving towards us. What do you want to do, Kathy? Do you want to still take questions or take a break? Okay.